So, good afternoon or good morning, depending on where you are. Thank you again for taking the time out of your busy day to join us in this first session of the NIEHS Superfund Research Program, or SRP, Risky Learning Webinar Series, Tools for PFAS Characterization. So, my name is Michelle Heacock again, and I am the director of the SRP. Because the SRP may be new to some of our audience members and it seems that we have a lot of audience members for today, so it's very exciting. Up to 1,000 people is my understanding. Before we start the presentations, my colleague Heather Henry and I wanted to take you through a few slides to give you some context of our program. I'll give you a really broad overview, and she'll dive into some of the details on our PFAS research. So, next slide, please. So, the Superfund Research Program was established by Congress in 1986 under the Superfund Amendment Reauthorization Act to fund basic research that seeks solutions to the complex health and environmental issues associated with the nation's hazardous waste sites, with the ultimate goal of improving public health. It is part of the National Institutes of Environmental Sciences that you see here on the right, which is one of the 20 institute centers of the National Institutes of Health, which is shown on the left. To learn more about the SRP, we encourage you to visit the website either by clicking on the link or scanning the QR code. Next slide, please. We also recently released a video providing an overview of the program. I invite you to watch this video to learn more about the program. Again, you can click on the link or scan the QR code. Next slide, please. SRP, a little bit about what we do. We provide grants to universities and small businesses to solve complex environmental health problems through multidisciplinary research to help reduce cleanup costs, decrease exposure to contaminants, and improve human health. As I mentioned, the Superfund Amendments and Reauthorization Act established a broad mandate and a set of goals for the NIHS to pursue within the SRP. I won't read through these four mandates that you're seeing here on the slide, but the mandates include the elements of determining health effects, helping assess risk and detection of hazardous substances, and remediation of hazardous substances related to Superfund sites. Next slide, please. This slide just gives you an idea of the several grant mechanisms that we use to fund research that meets the goals of the mandates you just saw. The majority of the program is funded under the P42 mechanism, which are our multi-project center grants, and they're shown in these darker blue circles on this map. The map also shows spread of the funding mechanisms across the country. I encourage you to check out the SRP website to learn more about the research funded under these grant mechanisms and upcoming funding opportunities. The links are available at the bottom of this slide. So now it is my pleasure to turn it over to my colleague, Dr. Heather Henry, who will talk about PFAS research supported by the SRP and will provide an overview of the webinar series. Heather, I turn it to you.
Okay, thank you, Michelle. We wanted to move from our large portfolio of grantees and focus just on the PFAS-related ones. So out of the grant projects that we fund that Michelle was talking about 46 of those are PFAS-related, whether that's biomedical remediation, we have a strong community engagement component, as well as research translation. And then more relevant to our series here, about a third of that total area on PFAS grants are related to the modeling and detection technologies. So we will not be going over any details about PFAS, but there is a great NIEHS webpage that talks about PFAS, and the link to that is below. And maybe we'll move to the next slide, please. And before we begin, I did want, out of the 46 projects, we have done several features, and so you may be interested in some of these. Research Briefs is our monthly feature of the science and activities that are coming out of our grant and includes a podcast. And then we also have news stories, a whole digest that talked about all of the overview of the PFAS work that we do, as well as public health impact stories and then other webinars. So these slides will be available on the webinar webpage. So we encourage you to check out some of these resources. And if you're interested in joining any of those mailing lists, there's a link here to SRP info at nih.gov. And then the next slide, please. I just wanted to highlight a few federal activities that NIEHS has been involved with, either ourselves as staff or as at some of our grant recipients. On the left, last year, there was a report that was released by the National Academy of Science, Engineering, and Medicine that guides clinicians in evaluating patients for PFAS exposure and addressing associated health effects. A lot of several of our SRP grant recipients participated in that panel, put together a very valuable overview of some of the many health endpoints that are under investigation. Some of them with clear connection to PFAS, other where we need a little more information to really understand if there's a causal effect. So encourage you to go and have a look at that. And then I believe it was in March, a White House working group called the Joint Subcommittee of Environmental Innovation and Public Health released sort of a state of the science of PFAS, includes challenges that need to be addressed in a government-wide effort, which will then lead to, hopefully in the coming year, a whole of government strategic plan approach for PFAS. So please be on the lookout for that. And then I'll have to say that the series that we're doing now on tools for site characterization really does dovetail and was inspired from the Federal Remediation Technology Roundtable, which is going to be having a fall meeting in Reston, Virginia, but also available online through ClueIn, and that's going to be on November 7th. And that's going to focus more on field-ready applications and tools for PFAS characterization. Today's webinar, maybe we can move to the next slide. Today's webinar is going to feature work that's undergoing within our program and very innovative, may not be ready for prime time just yet, but nonetheless, something that we want the public to be aware of because it's some great work going on, forward thinking. And as sort of a connection from the FRTR webinar that's happening next month, it's a great segue to introduce our moderator, because Andrea Tokranov from the USGS will be presenting during that webinar, talking about some of her work, understanding background concentrations that she's been doing as a particular case study. So with that, I will use that as an opportunity to hand it off to Dr. Tokranov to introduce today's webinar and speakers. And thank you for your attention, everyone.
Thank you, Heather. All right. With that, we are ready to get started. It is now my great pleasure to introduce our speakers. We will start with Dr. Diana Aga, the Henry Woodburn Professor of Chemistry at the State University of New York at Buffalo. Dr. Aga's research involves studying the fate, transport, effects, and treatment of chemicals of emerging concern and persistent organic pollutants in the environment. Dr. Aga, I will now turn it over to you.
Thank you, Andrea, for the introduction, and I'm going to share my slides. Okay, Andrea, how does my slide look? Does it show in my voice?
Can you hear? Yes.
Okay.
It's great.
Thank you. Thank you. All right. Well, thank you, everyone, for joining us, and thank you to our moderator. It's really a pleasure for me to be here today and serve in the same panel with two of the most prominent analytical chemists in the U.S. and maybe in the world who are doing PFAS analysis and really advancing the area of PFAS analysis, especially in unknown identification. So I don't think I need to introduce a lot about PFAS, because I'm sure the reason why you're here is because you know about PFAS. But I will focus more on the challenges of the analytical techniques, because many of these characterizations that we do in the environment or also doing risk assessment depend heavily on the power of our analytical tools. So beyond the typical liquid chromatography mass spectrometry, which is here abbreviated as LC, high resolution mass spec. Most of the applications now are using high resolution mass spec, although there are still a lot of us that are doing triple quadrupole mass spec, which is for quantitation. Beyond these chromatographic techniques, I would focus a little bit more on less used techniques, which is supercritical fluid chromatography or SFC, and combustion ion chromatography or CIC, and fluorine NMR, which stands for nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy. And my presentation is not to replace LC-MS, but to introduce some of you to the power of these complementary techniques to help us advance our efforts to identify new PFAS that have not been identified before, or to help us characterize some of the byproducts that are produced when we do remediation. So again, just very briefly, I don't want to talk about where how PFAS are there or what the effects are PFAS, but just to emphasize that perfluoroalkyl substances is everywhere. It's used a lot in many products, consumer products, and industrial products, and therefore they end up being in different kinds of environment, from wastewater to drinking water to rain. But in the analytical chemistry world, the diversity of PFAS, as you can see in this very few representative, gives us a lot of challenges, because PFAS have different head groups, from carboxylates to sulfonates. It also occurs, oh, here's another one with phosphate group. It also occurs as long chain or short chain or branched or with ethers or cyclic. So because of these various different chemical properties of PFAS, it provides challenges in separation and detection for chemical analysis. The other thing is, because they occur in various environments, the matrix also gives us challenge in terms of quantification. So it the method for drinking water is not going to work for analysis of biosolids or wastewater or leachates. So that also creates different kinds of problems in terms of quantification. And to add to the challenge, there's lack of reference standards for many of these compounds. In fact, the EPA method 1633 includes only 40 PFAS out of the more than 12,000 reported PFAS in the EPA master list. So therefore, because of this diversity in chemicals, we also need diverse methods. So many of the typical analytical chemistry that is being used use liquid chromatography or gas chromatography for determining PFAS in environmental samples. And even the mass spectrometry, there are various types. There's ion trap, there's triple quad, there's QTOF, Orbitrap, and so on and so forth. And having the right tools is really key to PFAS analysis in these different techniques. So in addition to the target analysis that we have been accustomed to do, many of the previous work have done target analysis using LC-MS, which basically, in target analysis, we know what we're looking for. We have defined the number of chemicals we're looking for. So we have it's quantitative. So we have, just to give you an example, this clear peaks that shows in our chromatography, where each peak represents one compound. So the signal-to-noise ratio is high. We can quantify at trace level, but we are limited to the number of PFAS that we can analyze using targeted analysis. For example, I mentioned the 1633 EPA method that's being proposed only includes 40 PFAS. But it's good because it's quantitative. But we all know that there are many other kinds of PFAS that have not been analyzed or identified. So more and more people are going towards non-target analysis, where we are looking for other PFAS that have not been identified or have not been characterized. So the question here is, what else could be present? And so then the next two talks, actually, I'm really happy that they are following me, because they're going to focus more on this non-target analysis using databases and other tools that I will not emphasize here in my talk. So the first method that I would like to mention here is the use of NMR. So NMR is used a lot in organic chemistry and characterizing organic compounds, but it's less used in analytical chemistry because the limitation of NMR is it uses a lot of materials. It does not have the sensitivity that LC-MS has, but it has its own advantages. So in these two publications that we have here, we demonstrated that we can use NMR, specifically fluorine NMR, to help us identify compounds that have not been identified, especially in complex matrices like biosolids. So fluorine NMR can be used to characterize and quantify PFAS with minimal background and signal interferences. In fact, in this publication that we have here, we use it for biosolids, and we did not have to use solid phase extraction to clean it up. Our samples was brown and dirty, but we were able to get signals for fluorine because the NMR is looking only for the chemical shift for fluorine itself. The other thing about fluorine NMR is that it can be quantitative with even without the use of standards. So we can get total PFAS. And I'll show you how we have done it here. For example, so I just want to emphasize here that this is not a chromatogram in case, because we're so used to using LC-MS. So this is an NMR signal here. The x-axis is chemical shift. And also I want to show that because of the range of the chemical shift, we broke it here. So there's a gap here from 82 to 165. But I will show you in the next slide when it has full spectra. But here I just wanted to show you that, for example, for a hexafluorobenzene, because the fluorine atom is within the same chemical atmosphere, you only see one fluorine signal at the chemical shift of 165. So this is used as a reference signal for our PFAS. On the other hand, here, this is a trifluoroacetic acid, where the fluorine is also only in the CF3 signal here. So it's also one signal for the fluorine NMR. However, in the fluorine attached to carbon in the chain of the PFAS, you can see some splitting and some other coupling for these fluorine signals. But what I would like to emphasize here is we can actually use these signals for characterizing PFAS. So in our publication where we showed individual spectra for fluorine NMR, we demonstrated in that publication that, the fluorine signal from the terminal CF3 is far removed from the fluorine signal from the carbon chain. So let's just focus on the perfluoropentanoic acid here. The CF2 here, the fluorine signal from the carbon closest to the carboxylic acid is here in the signal A. And that's the same, almost the same signal for the fluorine in the carbon closest to the carboxylic group. So you could use that as a signature for a carboxylated PFAS. The other fluorines here are here, and there's a lot of coupling and splitting. So it could be a little complex to use, but just to let you know that they can be used to characterize PFAS as well, is if you have high signal. But mainly for PFAS analysis in complex matrix, we want to capitalize on the fact that the CF3 here signal is far removed from the other fluorine signal. So, and it doesn't matter whether it's fluorinated, it's carboxylated or sulfonated, they all occur in the 82 ppm. So in other words, if you have different PFAS from different with different head groups and different PFAS from Adona with ethers and branching, this terminal PFAS will give you a signal, a CF3 shift, about 82 ppm. So you could use that as a total PFAS signal for quantification for various kind of PFAS, even if you don't know the exact feature or the exact character of the PFAS. So we use this in characterizing or quantifying biosolids, total PFAS in a biosolid that we have, using the hexafluorobenzene as our reference material. So we know that we have six fluorine in this unknown amount of hexafluorobenzene. So from there, we can estimate the amount of CF3 in the biosolid without sample preparation. We basically extracted it with methanol and centrifuge it and put it in our NMR tube, and we can analyze the total PFAS in this biosolid sample, which is very challenging if we do LC-MS because of the matrix effect, because of the losses that we do for cleanup, and so forth. So from just to summarize this power of NMR, when we actually compare the total PFAS in this work with a method using the total oxidizable precursor assay, which is also used a lot for characterizing PFAS in many samples, we have quantified the CF3 signal using NMR and showed that by NMR, by fluorine NMR, we can determine 63% higher total PFAS compared to the what's quantified using total oxidizable precursor assay, which means that there are many other PFAS that we are missing when we use a top assay for quantifying total PFAS. And in this work, we have also found that most of these PFAS is in the form of trifluoroacetic acid, which is this compound here, very short chain PFAS. And we don't see this in LC-MS because many of our typical LC-MS methods use C18 column, which is nonpolar. And because this is very polar, it is not retained in the LC-MS column. So it just goes through the chromatography. So therefore, we cannot quantify it in our typical LC-MS methods. People now are trying to use polar column like Helic and some other functionalized C18 to add to the polarity to try to determine the ultra short chain PFAS. So many people now are recognizing there are C2 and C3 and C4 PFAS that are not quite captured in the LC-MS column. So that's one of the things that we found in using NMR. So the problem with the typical LC-MS column that we use, well, it's not the problem, it's the limitation, I should say, is that the column we use for LC-MS are nonpolar. So therefore, the very polar ultra short chain PFAS are missed. So probably many of you have heard of supercritical fluid chromatography, but it's not something that is commonplace in many labs. In fact, even our laboratory does not have SFC. So the work that I'm going to present here is something that we obtained by going to Waters lab because we are trying their SFC machine. So we don't own it yet, but we have gathered very interesting results so that I want to share here. So SFC uses a polar stationary phase and typically a supercritical fluid CO2, which is nonpolar. So it's a normal phase chromatography. But in so supercritical fluid, as you may remember, for some of you, this is the phase diagram. There's a supercritical region above liquid and gas phase. So this is the supercritical point. Above this supercritical temperature and pressure is a supercritical region where you can have a chemical like CO2 that combines the properties of gas and liquid. So it's in the supercritical stage or phase. CO2 has a viscosity similar of those gas and density similar of those fluid. So it can be used as a mobile phase. And the instrument itself is very much similar to LC-MS. So the mass spec is the same, the pump are the same, but the mobile phase is CO2. And there's a restrictor, there's an added component that keeps the CO2 in its supercritical fluid space. So using CO2 as a mobile phase, you can perform a different kind of chromatography and a different type of interactions, separations in SFC. For example, here and in the top chromatography here is the chromatography we obtain using liquid chromatography mass spectrometry using C18 columns, so the typical C18 we use in the PFAS analysis. And as you can see here, with a non-polar column, the most polar ultra-short chains come out very quickly, and the more non-polar PFAS are retained longer. Okay. Now, when you do SFC, the retention times are reversed. So here, it's the mucosa. I put here the structure, long chain, more non-polar chain here. Now is less retained, and the PFBA, or the four carbon chain sulfonic acid, is now most retained. So there's a switch in the retention time. That allows us to be able to separate some of the more short chain, very polar PFAS, okay? So it gives you an orthogonal method for analysis of PFAS. We used it to determine an extract that we have done for, we've analyzed for LC-MS. We use the same extract, it's a waste-activated sludge, to analyze. And here you can see that the longer chains are less retained, and the TFA, so the trifluoroacetic acid that we could not retain in C18, is now coming out at 9 minutes, or almost 10 minutes. So this is the carboxylated, and these are the sulfonated PFAS. So the PFBS, the four chain, is now being retained as 8.6 minutes. So again, it's a nice complementary technique for LC-MS. And we actually estimated, I say estimate because we didn't put a C13 labeled analogs for SPE, for extracting them. So this is pure estimate. And you can see with this estimation, we could quantify, well, semi-quantify TFA, and it has almost the same concentration as the PFOA and PFOS, the C8 carboxylate and the sulfonated PFAS. Now, I would like to emphasize here that this is really underestimate of TFA, because we extracted this using solid phase extraction with HLB cartridge, which would lost, or it actually has HLB and an ion exchange. So in HLB, we will lose a lot of TFA. In fact, I read some article that the recovery of TFA in HLB or C18 is less than 5%. So for sure, we have lost a lot of TFA in this extract, because we were not using this extract for SFC. But we saw we still obtained TFA, most likely because of the anion exchange cartridge. So I turn now to the use of combustion ion chromatography, because this one we actually have in our lab. And typically with the LC-MS, we do it for target PFAS analysis, where we know what we're looking for, and we have limited number of PFAS in our analytical method. But really, we are interested in the total fluorine. Okay, so the total fluorine in our samples. And most importantly, we are interested in the organofluorine component, not so much with the inorganic fluorine, but for characterizing PFAS, we are interested in the adsorbable organic fluorine and the total organofluorine, which we can do in combustion ion chromatography. So for those of you who are not familiar with this, just very briefly, in the combustion ion chromatography, we actually have these little autosampler boats made of ceramics, and we could put our solid sample here directly, or extract, or the adsorb PFAS, if we are going through adsorbable PFAS. We could put this in ceramic boat, and it undergoes combustion at high temperature, and it converts everything to fluoride ion, which we can separate using ion chromatography. So what we see are not the PFAS, but the fluoride ion produced. If you have organochlorines or organobromine, they are also combusted, and you can also see them as chloride and bromide, which is an additional information you could use if you're characterizing biosolids. So we have this workflow for our biosolid analysis, where we do several extractions. We split it into extracting with methanol, and we use it for our LC-MS analysis, for target analysis, which we need to clean up by SPE. In that SPE, we can analyze it or also analyze it for CIC and get extractable organic fluorine. Or we can analyze the biosolid directly for total fluorine. But because we're interested in the organofluorine, we could also extract it and pass it through an activated carbon for the adsorbable carbon, and then get this adsorbed fluorine in the carbon by directly measuring or combusting the carbon and get the adsorbable organic fluorine. So with this flow chart, with this workflow, we can have several information from extractable organic fluorine to adsorbable and total fluorine. And again, interestingly, I'd like to show here that in the total fluorine, where we combusted the biosolid itself directly, we have, so this is fluorine concentration in ppb, and then we add here the information that we get from the adsorbable organic fluorine, where we pass it through the activated carbon, and by subtraction we can graph it with the to determine the non-extractable extractable and non-adsorbable AOF, and you can see there's still a lot of organic fluorine that we cannot account for with our method. And you could also see here that the target PFAS that we analyze by LC-MS is just a small fraction of the total fluorine that we should see in the biosolids. But by the way, these are converted in terms of fluoride. So because that, as I mentioned earlier, the CIC only analyze in terms of fluoride ion as in organofluoride. So in this graph, we've converted all the target PFAS in terms of fluorine equivalent. I'd like to end my presentation here to segue it to the next talk, actually, on ion mobility mass spec. We just acquired an ion mobility mass spec, but it's a little bit different than what you will hear from the next presentation, in that this is basing on cyclic ion mobility. The cyclic ion mobility mass spec, which you will hear a little bit more about in the next talk, can separate PFAS isomers, stereoisomers, based on their collisional cross-section of the molecule. So here I show you in this cartoon that these two PFAS with the same molecular weight, which you cannot separate by a high resolution mass spec in terms of their mass, can be separated on the ion mobility mass spectrometry because of their difference in collision cross-section. We are just really installing this thing, but I would like to show you that the typical PFAS chromatogram that we see in the liquid chromatography, where we see only one peak here in the liquid chromatography mass spectrometry, with the ion cyclic mobility, we see different peaks because these actually have different isomers. In these visuals here, you can see, so the drift time on the y-axis and the increasing retention time, this chromatogram that we normally see in this type of presentation, we can actually see the, several isomers that's separating in one pass. In the cyclic ion mobility, you can do several pass. So when you do more pass in this cyclic ion mobility mass spec, you can see even further separations of these isomers. And so in addition to the difference in their molecular, in their ion mobility, their fragmentation will allow you to also identify some of these isomers of the perfluorohexane sulfonic acid. So here, as we click on this isomer here, you can see the different fragmentation of this isomer 4, which is different than the linear PFAS. So this is the linear PFAS, where you can see a lot higher molecular ion versus here. So based on this fragmentation pattern, you can also it can also help you identify some of these isomers. So again, these are all preliminary data. We just installed our instrument, so I don't have a lot of this. But again, to just to introduce you to the other instrumentation that can help us characterize our PFAS in the different sites that were especially really complex matrices like leachate. So here I could show you a comparison of the ion mobility mass spec data of the standard. So this is the standard PFAS and the leachate. I switched the thing here. So this is the leachate and this is the standard. And you can see with the leachate, there's a little bit of a shift in the retention time. And that's very common with high matrix effect. But that's why you need the high resolution mass spec to really show that that's the compound you are looking for. So not relying only on retention time, because you will see some of this small shift in retention time when you're doing chromatography with matrix, complex matrix. So that's that for the ion mobility that we have tried, and you will hear more about it in the next talk. But to summarize, the advantages of NMR is that it can quantify PFAS without standards. It's not prone to matrix effect, and you don't need a lot of sample prep. We only basically extract it with solid liquid extraction, no SPE, centrifuge, and that's it. But of course, as I mentioned, it's not high throughput, it's long-term, it's long analysis time, and it's not suitable for trace analysis. The supercritical fluid mass spec is good because it retains ultra-short PFAS, but it's not very much available in many labs. So there's still very few have SFC. In fact, I searched the literature. I've only seen one publication for PFAS on SFC. The CIC is getting more and more common. It's good for providing total PFAS, total fluorine, because you can combust the biosolids. But the limitation is it lacks structural information, because you can only measure the fluoride ion after combustion. And of course, this new upcoming, I have heard more and more people getting this, using the CCS values for ion mobility, and hence that's why we acquired it more recently. With that, I'd like to thank the people who actually do all this work, my students, and acknowledge the award that we got from the National Institute of Environmental Health Science, and also a supplement that helped Carla Rios to do some of this SFC work with Waters, and we're actually doing we're installing our instrument, a homemade SFC, to be able to let us analyze the short chain PFAS. With that, I'd like to end my presentation here.
Thank you very much, Dr. Aga. A reminder that you may submit your questions by using the Q&A pod. So to start off with, the first question is, how concentrated were the NMR samples, and in what solvent were they? Also, how much overlap is there in the CF2 region, and how likely would it be to differentiate multiple similar PFAS?
Okay, that's a loaded question. All right, thank you. So first question is, how concentrated? The biosolid we've actually... we can detect, so instrumental detection limit is 50 ppb with like 50 ppb standard of PFOS. But the biosolid sample that I showed you, I think it was about, so when we concentrated it, it was about 500 ppb. After we used 200 milligrams of the biosolids, we extracted with methanol with water, but mostly methanol. And we have to evaporate the methanol to get rid of the OH, because in NMR, it has to be deuterated solvent. So we replace the methanol with deuterated methanol, and then you can do the NMR. Was there another question? Oh, the overlap. The
Yes.
overlap for the fluorinate, for the fluorine in the backbone, in the chain, they overlap a lot. So you, unless it's pure, you can assign it. But in complex biosolids, it's very difficult, if not impossible. Maybe you need a lot of deconvolution, but we are unable to use those signals on the CF in the chain for identifying structural features. But we can, but as I mentioned, because of the CF3 terminal is so far removed from the other signal of the fluorine in the chain, we can use it to for the CF3, for the terminal CF3.
Perfect, thank you. The next question is, can CIC analysis be used to sample blood?
Yes, we're actually trying that. We can burn the serum and it converts it to fluoride. We are still struggling with detection limits to match the LC-MS detection limits, but there are some ways we're trying to figure out for sample prep. But yes, it can be used for blood.
Excellent. All right, next question. The wastewater from activated sludge, was this in and around Superfund sites?
No, it was actually from a municipal wastewater.
Okay, great. Looks like the next one is more of a comment, but I guess it, can you talk a little bit about the detection limit for PFAS using the SFC?
Yeah, so unfortunately, we haven't done that because, as I mentioned, we don't even own SFC, but we used it from a company because we're trying to see its potential for ultra chain. But just the compound that we used, that we were able to detect, the PFBA, is the same sample that we use for our LC-MS. So I think basically because the detection is based on the mass spec, so it is equivalent to the mass spec detection that you use for liquid chromatography. Because remember, this, so the SFC, the supercritical fluid chromatography, is only for the separation, but it's the same detection limit for the mass spec, and it's the same ionization.
Excellent.
Yeah, let me add a little bit more too, but this is, I haven't done it completely, but I think theoretically you can actually achieve a lower detection limit in SFC because you can remove some of the matrix, because the chromatography removes some of the matrices. So that might improve the ionization suppression. But it's just, my answer is based on theory. So I have to yet to prove it.
Excellent. All right. Well, we will have to move on. We're at the limit for the questions. I'd like to introduce our next speaker here. We have Dr. Aaron Baker, an associate professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Dr. Baker's research utilizes advanced separations and novel software capabilities to examine how chemical exposure affects human health. Dr. Baker, I will now turn it over to you.
Thanks so much, Andrea. Do I sound okay? And can you see my slides?
Yes, on both accounts.
Great. So I'm very excited to be talking to you all today about some work that my group is doing within the Texas A&M Superfund Research Program and some collaborations we have along the way. So those people will pop up as I go through my slides. But using multidimensional separations and also non-targeted analyses, like Diana alluded to in her talk. So my group is really interested in how chemical exposure affects human health and the life cycle of that. And when we think of the chemicals that we're exposed to things through our diet, our lifestyle, the pollutants that we might be getting from those nice salads that we're eating for our food, different drugs we might be taking, whether it's antibiotics for illnesses or other ones. Cosmetics we might be putting on ourselves. So the toothpaste you might be using at night to brush your teeth or in the morning, and then your lotions too. And then one that always scares me is our consumer products, and especially the recent papers that are coming out about how they're finding PFAS in our toilet paper and for females' feminine hygiene products. So when we're exposed to these different xenobiotics, and especially PFAS, they'll go into our systems and they'll possibly be metabolized, or if they're super robust, they might just roam around as the parent compounds. But they also affect our endogenous metabolism. And understanding both the effects of these xenobiotics in our system and how they affect that endogenous metabolism is extremely important. So when we pull that down, we can see that with our normal metabolism and the KEG pathway, we could see changes in our metabolites, in our lipids, in our proteins, and our glycans. And we can do measurements to follow these with indirect measurements, but then we also can do direct measurements of these different xenobiotics or exposures that we might be getting. So one of the questions my group has is how can we combine these two measurement types and learn more about what exposure is doing to us? So I always like to thank these guys at the very beginning of the talk because the end always gets rushed. So this is my group that I each are looking at different types of omic analyses, and then they come together and really look or combine their measurements to really look better at those system perturbations. So the color around their picture is the omic that they specialize in, matching to the key on the right. So you can see some are specializing in exposomics, while we have others in lipidomics and proteomics and so on. So when we think of traditional non-targeted analyses, a lot of people use some type of chromatography and then some type of mass spectrometry to do these evaluations. And like Diana showed, there's many, many other types of evaluations too, but commonly we think of this chromatography and mass spectrometry. But we're really working to get more information on just these two-dimensional analyses, and we might call them three-dimensional analyses if you look at the fragmentation with the mass spectrometry and the precursor molecules. So our goal is to bring in ion mobility spectrometry, and Diana gave a nice introduction to the cyclic version that uses a traveling wave ion mobility spectrometer. But we actually use drift tube-based ion mobility, and each has its benefits, and you can do a lot of the same things with the different types of ion mobility. So, one thing about ion mobility, though, I want to focus on is it's very fast. So it's a very fast separation technique, but it provides the structural information. So the power of that is that when we combine it with mass spectrometry, we get both the mass and the M over Z information, but also the size information. So if we have two molecules here on the left side that have the exact same M over Z, one's bound up more in a ring-based structure and one's bound in a more linear-based structure. If we pulse them into our drift tube, filled with an inert buffer gas like nitrogen, the one that's more bound up is going to have fewer interactions with that nitrogen gas, come out faster, and have a shorter drift time than the one that's more elongated. So in our mass spectrum, we would see just one M over Z peak, but now we can say there's two different forms of that M over Z peak, which might match to conformers and it might match to isomers. And so the reason we really want to employ ion mobility is because it is so fast. So it's on a millisecond time scale. So it, for people that like chromatography, you could think of it like size exclusion chromatography, but that's on a minutes to hour type of time scale. Here, because it's on milliseconds, we can put it right after our chromatography separation and right before our mass spectrometry separation and get an extra dimension of analysis that goes along with any assay. So we're not taking any extra time, we just get that extra separation for free. We also have these ion neutral collision cross sections that we can get out, and that's basically how the molecule interacts with the buffer gas. And you can see on the right, we have a sphere around our analyte. And so that sphere is that interaction area or surface area that that molecule takes up when it goes through that buffer gas. And since our molecules go through with a constant velocity, we can compare that to these different ion mobility approaches like Diana's showing or other people that might be using trapped ion mobility with Bruker instruments and other types of ion mobility separations too. Ion mobility also has benefits for many of the different omic analyses because we are getting a lot of this separation information and more molecular information. So the problem with ion mobility, though, is I've been fortunate to use ion mobility in my career for quite some time, and I started actually when I was an undergrad, and it's carried through me for the last 20-ish years. But the hard thing we always had was that it was very big data when you start doing much multidimensional analyses. And you can see here that this is what one data file would look like. You'd get millions of different points based on the features that you're seeing through the retention time, the mass time, and the drift time. And some of those are the same feature that we're seeing in multiple scans, but now we have to combine those and figure out what's the same and what's different. We had to start thinking about the ionization we're using and the extraction we're using also, because we can bias our separations based on that. And how can we treat this big data if we need to run different extractions and different ionization methods per data set? So what some people have started doing is making these collision cross-section databases. And this has really started off probably about 15 years ago with David Clemmer's group from Indiana University. But John McClain's group really took a bite out of this too when they brought out the CCS compendium to show a small molecule metabolite database of over 3,800 different metabolites. Our group has been trying to add to this information so it's publicly available, and anybody that's doing ion mobility analyses can actually take that information and apply that to their evaluations. So we have also added different metabolites to the compendium and also acylcarnitines and a lot of lipidomic work. We want to make sure that we're including our exposomic molecules, though. So we've been working on adding PFAS and other types of exposure molecules, especially with the Rusin lab at Texas A&M. And we're looking specifically here at the ToxCast and analyzing the different standards that are available with the ToxCast. There's somewhere around 4,685 molecules. And what the ToxCast includes is 13 different chemical classes that go anywhere from different cosmetic ingredients to pesticides to color dyes to surfactants. And we're right in the middle of that right now. So we're hoping to have a great data set of these collision cross sections available for others doing exposure-based analyses. Another thing that ion mobility is very powerful in is interference removal. And when we do these multidimensional evaluations, you can see here, this is an LC, total ion chromatogram. And if we're specifically looking for a molecule that comes out at about 22 minutes, we can select that area. And because this is big data, this is our four-dimensional data, I'm going to just show it in multiple different two-dimensional plots. With here, I'm going to show with intensity as color. So here, once we go into that LC and we pick 1 second scan from that LC time frame, we can pick our mass spectrometry information to be on the x-axis, so down on the bottom, and then our ion mobility information to be on the y-axis. And this is often termed a nested spectra. The colors then are determining what abundance the molecules are actually coming in here. And so you can see that using that ion mobility information, we can really see the envelopes that the different ions come in. So we can see their C12 forms, so the molecular ion, plus the M plus one, M plus two, and M plus three peaks for these different ones. However, if we want to clean up that bottom, we can specifically select an area. So this might be our molecule of choice. Take that drift time and slice it out, and we basically get rid of all the noise from the other molecules that were in that same M over Z area. And here we actually had a stable isotope labeled molecule that had six C13 carbons, so we could see the difference between our spiked stable isotope label versus our molecule that's naturally in the sample. And we can even do some quantitation from that, knowing what we spiked our stable isotope label at. What I really want to demonstrate today, though, is how important ion mobility is for trend line relationships when we put it with the mass spec information and put those together. And so here we can see a paper from John McClain where he showed this for different molecule types and how that if your atoms are packed in a very ring-based type of packing, so more in our nucleotides and our carbohydrates, at every specific M over Z, those ones will have smaller collision cross. sections. But as our molecules are packed and more extended, like lipids, we get larger collision cross sections. So now if we do a non-targeted evaluation, determine our features and see which features are coming out of our instrument, we get an M over Z and a CCS for each feature for free. Now we can go and tell you what type of backbone your feature might have. So my group has tried to replicate this by getting more standards and making sure that we saw the same trend lines as the McLean group. And we did. So for these bigger molecules, but we said, wonder if we start looking at more small molecules and hit those that are below 700 M over Z. And so again, we started to see trend line relationships, which we thought were really interesting, where we could see again that our more, our smaller CCS values went with our nucleotides and our nucleosides that are more ring-based type of molecules. And if we went per M over Z to the larger CCS molecules, we saw more lipid type of molecules or more extended molecules. But we did find something we thought was interesting and that kind of correlated back to these different exposure-based molecules is we saw that halogenated molecules were completely on a different trend line and at a lower trend line. So this was confusing at first because we said our most compact molecules should have lower collision cross sections, but now we've got another trend line that's still a compact molecule, but it has a lower collision cross section. Then we remembered that our halogens have a lot of mass. So bromine has a mass of about 79 or 81, depending on what isotope you look at. But it doesn't have a 79 or 81 times that size in that atom that it's adding to the molecule. And so we're not seeing as big of a cross-section increase as we would if we were in a more hydrogenated molecule. And so this made us think, well, let's start probing the molecules that are more halogenated like PFAS. And so that's what brought us into the PFAS adventure. And I know that people have already talked about PFAS, but what I want to specifically note here is that how 14,000 PFAS are listed in various points of the PFAS tox master list by the EPA, but there's only about 200 standards. And so this is where non-targeted analyses becomes extremely important, because how are we going to cover evaluations of those other 13,800 molecules, plus many more that we don't even know exist? And so especially we know that our legacy PFAS have pretty easy structures to analyze where they just have different head groups and carbon chains. But now that we're getting into emerging PFAS, we're starting to get ether linkages and branching, and we're even seeing some with multi-head groups. And so how do we pick those out from really complex mixtures? And so when we go back to our ion mobility versus our mass spec trend line, what we see is if we take all the PFAS standard, or this is a subset of the PFAS standards we ran just for clarity, we see a big difference in where those CCS values are versus our more biological space or hydrogenated molecules. And again, they're at much lower collision cross-section values than what we would expect in a hydrogenated molecule that is even our ring-bound molecules, which are kind of at that border of that yellow and that gray trend line here. And if we specifically look at some molecules that have similar M over Zs, we can see for PFAS, something that might have an M over Z around 220 would give us a C4F9 type of structure, where if we go to our more hydrogenated molecules, we're at C12H23O2. So you can imagine that 12 carbons is going to be much longer. But because those fluorines have that 19 Dalton mass, it really increases the M over Z of the molecule without adding the number of carbons. So a much shorter chain length versus a much longer chain length in our biological space. And this is allowing us to basically take these targeted lists and try and inform them from our non-targeted analysis. And Diana did a great job of showing us how this can be done. But we know that our targeted lists are only going to cover maybe 40 PFAS, and now we really want to get into that space where new PFAS are coming out. We might have transformation products, and we really need to inform these targeted lists of what's present in the environment or present in people's blood. So in our non-targeted PFAS discovery workflow, what we're doing is we're going through and we're collecting our data by these multidimensional approaches where we're doing liquid chromatography, mass spectrometry, and ion mobility. And then we're finding all of the features that are coming out and finding all the information for these different dimensions to put into our next filtering area. So in our feature filtering, what we do is we do mass defect filtering, then we do the collision cross-section filtering. So looking specifically at where those molecules hit at the trend lines, and we select specifically if we want to look at the CF2 based molecules or if we want to look at the CH2 based molecules. Then we can, if we think it might belong to a homologous series, then we can look at the difference between the CF2 additions, which is about 50 Daltons. Or we can leave that step out too, because this might be a novel PFAS that doesn't have longer or shorter chains that are present. So all of these steps can be left out. This just allows us more filtering to really look into all those features we're detecting. Then from that, the features that we detect, then we can go through the molecular formula assignments where we look at the molecules that we think or the atoms we think that are present and then go through suspect screening and then finally do structural elucidation using MSMS. And so basically cleaving off at different spots to validate what kind of branching we're seeing. And so what this data looks like, and I always love to show what the data looks like, is that if you do MSMS, it happens after the ion mobility separation in our instrument. And so the precursor has flown all the way through the drift tube, and now we break it. And so what that allows is it allows those fragment ions here shown in that maroon color to be co-aligned or co-drift with their precursor molecule because of that fragmentation later. And the precursor here is shown in hot pink. We know that everything at a different drift time is not correlated to that precursor mass. It's a fragment ion from a different molecule. And so we can ignore that when we're assigning what our molecular feature might be. And for an example, if we look at Nafion byproduct 6, if we don't do drift time filtering, when it's coming out of a blood sample in chromatography, only the peaks, the fragmentation peaks, should be the ones in color, but we're seeing all these other gray peaks that actually correspond to other molecules in the sample. However, if we do drift time filtering, all those gray peaks pretty much disappear, and we can see the colored peaks, which actually match to the transitions or the fragments we would expect for that molecule. So this allows us to basically take this non-targeted approach and do analyses from the environment with discovery and monitoring and move those into human health where we're looking ex at exposure and at metabolomic impacts. So as a few applications, and I'll have a couple of our collaborators popping up on these slides, I want to show you how we're using these non-targeted studies and where we can apply those to. And so we were specifically working on some aquatic passive samplers, and what they were was pretty simple, is they were rubber embroidery hoops, and they had LC stationary material in the inside, and then nylon mesh holding that stationary material in those embroidery hoop outlines basically. And then we could tie these off to different buoys and do water sampling. And while these weren't great for quantitation, we could get an idea of presence and absence of different chemicals that might be occurring in different water areas. So we worked with Astrid Snetzer on this project, where she'd deployed these different passive samplers at Jordan Lake, which is a main source of water for people in the Raleigh area, and then down here at King's Bluff. And she was actually looking for microcystins because she was interested in different algal blooms. But when she found out that they might actually bind to PFAS, she was curious if we wanted to study them and see what kind of PFAS might be occurring too at the same time, because there's a fluorochemical manufacturer that in between both of these sampling spots. And we wanted to see if there were different chemicals coming from that that we weren't seeing in the upper Jordan Lake passive samplers. So from that King's Bluffs area, we found 57 fluorinated features when we went through our non-targeted evaluation, where 36 of them were known and matched to our PFAS library, but 21 of them didn't match to the library and were unknown features. So we kept going through our non-targeted workflow, and we found 14 unique molecular formulas, and we're able to propose 11 different structures from that using MS, and then applying all the information from the different separations. So how we did this was using, this is going to show a homologous series example because it's nice and straightforward to follow. But we were able to look at PFESA or PFEESA, which was a standard in our library. And we put its M over Z versus retention time for that molecule, and then its M over Z versus CCS. We then had another spectral match to another molecule, PFPRESA, and then found two novel chemicals that had that perfect homologous series difference of 50 Daltons and matched really nice linearly to our LC MS graphs and then also our ion mobility M over Z graphs. And then when we looked at our fragmentation information, we were able to see the cleavages and the presence of the different bonds in the molecules. We've also been using this in pine needles as passive samplers. And so we've found that, and it was actually found clear back in China, they reported it in 2016 and then also in Europe in 2017, that pine needles work great as passive samplers because that waxy cuticle on the outside of the needle, if you scratch with your fingernail, actually collects different xenobiotics. And so we found that PFAS were one of the things that would actually collect in these pine needles. But when they did their initial studies, they were only looking for PFOA and PFOS and a few of those legacy compounds. So we really wanted to see if more emerging compounds were present. And so we went with Scott Belcher and we did sample collection around North Carolina where we were doing both shed and unshed needles from the trees because we know the trees keep the needles for 2 years. And we're looking specifically at the time points of 2018 and 2020 in this study. And again, around that chemical manufacturing plant and then in different areas such as different airports and coastal regions. And so from those pine needles, we started with our library of 100 PFAS. We found 76 different PFAS in all of the needles throughout our study. So not just in one tree, luckily, but our most contaminated tree was hitting somewhere above 30 PFAS that were collected in those needles. And they were from all different types of PFAS chemicals. And so we can go from the PF essays all the way to the PFASAs. So, and a lot of different classes in between. If we look at previous studies that were using these, like I said, in Europe and China, they were specifically looking at the PFCAs and the PFSAs. We really increased the information of the PFAS that were present and could be detected from these pine needles. One of the scariest sites for us was that our Raleigh-Durham International Airport was one of our most contaminated areas for PFSAs and PFCAs from C4 to C8, as it had 2 to 4 orders of magnitude higher concentrations than any other samples in our region. And this is the tree. So the trees look nice and healthy, but this is the tree that those samples were collected from. And just right across that fence is an Army National Guard military training base. Or sorry, not Army, a military training base. Another benefit of using these pine needle samples, though, is that we were actually able to go to herbaria samples and start looking clear back into the 1960s. And we could have went earlier, but they unfortunately treated their samples with mercury dipping. And so we couldn't use those, but we could actually use these samples and still see PFAS in them from the 1960s, which goes back 60 years. And so we definitely can see the foreverness in these chemicals as we saw presence in 1960. Of PFOA and PFOS. And a couple other studies that I'm going to showcase too are we worked with the Rusin Group on studying this Intercontinental Terminals Company fire, where it was a fire in March of 2019, and that they brought in 5 million liters of Class B firefighting foams to put out this chemical fire. So you can imagine that there probably was a lot of PFAS in these foams, and the picture of the fire is on the bottom left. What we were really interested in this study was to understand how the presence of PFAS changed throughout time after so much PFAS was sprayed all over this fire. And so there were multiple sampling sites that were taken from this Galveston Bay area and near Houston where this fire was. And so you can see in red, here's the Inter Terminals Company and all this water that's surrounding it. So we specifically looked at also the firefighting foams, and they found that the most abundant PFAS in these were PFOS and 6,2-FTS. And so a lot of modeling was done within the Texas A&M Superfund to really understand the currents and the water flows in these areas. And then they took samples multiple times from March 2019 past June 2019, but I'm just going to show those time points where the red shows the highest amount of these two different PFAS in these water channels, and you can see those levels dropping throughout time. And so they always say dilution is the answer to pollution, but this really showcased that in that way. But we know because these are forever chemicals that that pollution is just moving to a different area in the water. And so to wrap up, I want to just show how we're linking exposure to health outcomes. And so for us, we're really interested in combining these exposomic analyses with other omic analyses. And especially when you start looking at a lot of the papers, like Heather showed at the beginning, of the increased cholesterol levels in people with higher PFAS levels and other types of li lipid consequences, unfortunately. So we've been working with Jamie DeWitt, who's now moved to Oregon State University, to understand that if mice are exposed to certain PFAS, what kind of lipid changes are we seeing in their different body parts, such as their liver? So the most recent study we looked at was looking at GenX at high exposure levels in mice where we had 19 controls and 11 that were exposed, and then we evaluated the lipid levels in their livers. And what we could see, and what you guys have probably already observed from different papers, is that PFAS accumulate different in different sexes. So females actually accumulate less GenX in the liver than males. And you can see here our control levels are basically zero for GenX, which we would hopefully expect. But that allows it makes it so we can't combine our different animal studies because we know of these different accumulations per sex. So we made sure to keep our statistics as sex-based statistics. So we detected 419 different lipids in these liver samples, and we found that 123 were significantly altered from these GenX responses. And there was some quite a bit of overlap between the males and females, but we do have specific lipids there. We also looked at some other exposures of PFAS in mice and then Nafion byproduct 2 in mice. And when we started looking at the lipids that were significant in all these studies, a majority of them are being upregulated in the animals that have exposure. And this matches very well with what we're seeing is that animals with high levels of different PFAS exposure have very enlarged livers, and so we're guessing that there's a lot of lipid accumulation due to exposure. And so I hope that I was able to show you guys the benefits of doing these multidimensional separations and how we're really diving more into the chemical space and learning more about these different applications using our ion mobility technology. And we're hoping future opportunities will be the ability to screen even more samples by having higher CCS libraries and this multidimensional information, and that we'll detect even more chemicals and fill in more space between that, what's available with standards and then what's not. So a big thank you to my funding sources, my collaborators, and my research group, and I'd be happy to take any questions.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Baker, for that very insightful presentation. Just a quick reminder that you can submit any questions using the Q&A pod. So I think we'll jump right into the first question. There are two easy ones to start with. The first one is asking if you're taking any new students for winter 2024 or fall 2024.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we're very excited to take more students.
Okay, great.
I
And
like
then
that one.
The second question is your library publicly available?
Yep. So our 100 chemical or our 100 PFAS library is currently available in one of our more recent publications that's on our website. And then we're working with the Rusin Group, and hopefully we'll have that big ToxCast exposure library available for everyone in the next year.
Excellent. All right. Next question. Is the presence of PFAS in the pine needles thought to be from absorption from the atmosphere or from uptake through the subsurface through the root structure?
That's a really good question. And we got that a lot at the very beginning of our study. So there were pseudo control studies that were done in Europe to assess that. And what they'd found, it's pretty hard because you almost have to grow the trees and then modify or have specific environments so they're not getting any PFAS exposure, because we actually didn't find a single tree yet that doesn't have any PFAS in their needles, which is a little bit scary. But what they found in their European study was a majority is atmospheric absorption, but there is a small amount that is coming from the roots that's actually traveling through the whole tree.
Great. Okay. And then next question, how do you analyze the chemicals in the pine tree needles? Do you first extract it and then analyze the extract? I think they're asking if you could talk a little bit more about the extraction process.
Definitely. So, plants are unfortunately very complex, and a lot of you guys know so many secondary metabolites in plants. And so, if we don't do a good extraction, there's just so many what we call them our contaminants, but it's some other people's molecules of interest. So, basically, so many molecules that are interfering with if we're looking specifically for PFAS. So, we do an SPE extraction for the pine needles, and we actually collect them and dry them and then actually grind them with a coffee grinder before we extract. So, it's kind of a funny process, but we had to make sure that our coffee grinder didn't have PFAS in it because there's PFAS prevalent in so many consumer products that we had to test it first before we could even use it.
Great. Okay. And then a follow-up question about the pine needles. Can they be used as phytoremediation for the uptake of PFAS?
Yeah, I love that question, because we have both. We think it's a great idea, but then it's like, what happened? What do you do with the pine needles? And so, a lot of our area in North Carolina, they spread pine needles all over the ground to stop weed control or to use as weed control. And so then there's worry that now we've got contaminated pine needles and we're actually spreading them also. And then now with the climate change and the big, forest fires, we know that there's PFAS in these needles. And so if your forest fires happen, how much is getting more aerosolized or transformed with the forest fires? So yeah, I think that's a great question. But then it's what do you do with the needles?
Yes, definitely challenging. Okay, the next question is asking, since the application and exposure measurements, would it be possible to estimate the airborne exposure levels from the studies? I assume maybe for the pine needle study.
Yeah, so we can spike in different heavy labeled PFAS and get a pseudo quantitation of these, but then there's a question of how much is like, are you overloading your needles basically in really toxic areas? And so we basically just look throughout our study and find point sources of the different types of PFAS. And we haven't really seen an overload of the needles from PFAS, but that would be another study where we really need to see, like, are we basically, do we have saturated needles with different chemical contaminants? But basically looking at our study, we can really find interesting point sources.
Great. All right. We will have to move on. Thank you again for that great presentation. Next, we will hear from Dr. Lee Ferguson, an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at Duke University. Dr. Ferguson's research is focused on the development of novel methods for trace analysis of organic and nanoparticulate contaminants in the aquatic environment. Dr. Ferguson, I will now turn it over to you.
Great. Okay. Thank you so much. It's a real pleasure to be here to give this presentation and especially to follow Diana's work and Aaron's work. So I'm going to continue the thread here about novel analytical approaches to study PFAS in the environment. So let's see. Here's my obligatory "What is PFAS?" slide. Of course, we all know most of this, but really, I put this up here just to remind us of of how pervasive these compounds have become in consumer products, in industrial applications, and in military uses around the world, and really how that's evolving. So we've moved from, in some cases, some of these legacy compounds that are used in, for example, coatings, firefighting foams, to novel and newer compounds, some of which we've seen examples of today, like Gen X. These are replacing some of the C8 compounds like PFOA and PFOS in, for example, coatings and fabrics. And one of the problems that we face as a community that struggles with environmental analytical chemistry of PFAS is the extreme complexity of these mixtures. And we've seen some really great examples of that today and how other researchers are tackling that with various different analytical approaches. Of course, high resolution mass spectrometry being one of the landmark methods, and I'm going to talk about that today. But the challenge really here is that the chemistries that we started with, these legacy perfluoroalkyl compounds like PFOA, are being replaced with these substitute compounds that are ethers, for example, and in some cases, polyfluorinated compounds like fluorotelomer-based chemistries. And so we find ourselves as a community playing a game of what I like to call environmental whack-a-mole, where we find a problem, we develop new methods to analyze particular compounds of concern, and then the industry shifts. And now we have different chemistries, and we have to be able to handle that both from an analytical standpoint, but also from a remediation and treatment standpoint. And that gives us some challenges. So today, I'm going to talk about how we are exploring the chemical and geographic space of PFAS in water. I'm going to split this up into two parts. So the first is talking about how we assess the problem scope. That is, how can we define the chemical universe of PFAS? And then how do we actually design analytical approaches that can measure as much of this PFAS chemical universe as possible? And so I'm going to talk about some advanced analytical chemistry methods. And in particular, I'm going to talk about some cheminformatics approaches that we've developed to try to expand this chemical universe that's available to us analytically. And then, of course, the question is, okay, well, now that we've developed these methods, how can we apply them? Can we survey the extent of the problem, for example, with PFAS? So in this case, you know, asking the questions, where does PFAS pollution pose a risk? And what are the major sources? So I'm going to talk about a case study in North Carolina waters. And actually, some of the maps might look familiar from Aaron Baker's presentation just a moment ago. So let's just jump right into the analytical chemistry here. One of the challenges immediately that we face with PFAS is the alphabet soup and the chemical the broad chemical scope of these compounds. So here's just a diagram from a great paper from Sanyun Wang and Ian Cousins and others, really showing the different classes of PFAS, everything from perfluoroalkyl acids that are legacy compounds up to polyfluorinated compounds and ethers, and then all the way down to fluorotelomer-based compounds and fluoropolymers. And so all of these compounds share, of course, these very strong carbon-fluorine aliphatic bonds, and this gives them their extreme persistence. Of course, it also makes them useful in applications for textile, for coatings, for firefighting foam with their sort of oleophobicity and hydrophobicity simultaneously. And so what we face is the question, how do we define the full list of compounds that encompass this entire class of PFAS? And so we've heard some discussions about how many compounds make up PFAS. And so this is really based on some database analyses. So what we set out to do is actually try to concatenate all of the information that we could find on the molecular databases of PFAS, and then extend that a bit with our cheminformatic approaches. Okay, so the first thing that we start with is our database of PFAS in commerce. Okay, and so maybe perhaps one of the best examples of a molecular database for PFAS is the one that's organized and made freely available by the EPA through their Comtox Chemicals Dashboard. And so at the time that we started this work, we had about 880,000 compounds in the chemistry dashboard. I think that's gone up over a million now. And then also we had a very comprehensive AFFF database. This is a database of molecules that were carefully curated by a team of researchers that I was involved with from aqueous film-forming foams that are used for firefighting. And we put that together really to serve as our sort of starting point for our database. The next thing we did is we actually used some computational tools. And this includes Biotransformer, which was software that was developed out of David Wishart's group. This actually encodes a number of different transformation rules, including environmental transformations that have been curated out of Evok, as well as from other researchers, as well as human metabolism. So it encodes those rules and allows you to apply those rules to take precursor compounds and generate putative transformation products. We also used the EPA's chemical transformation simulator, which at the time really was only able to do hydrolysis predictions, but we were able to do put these together to make predictions of hydrolysis as well as biotransformation products. And then importantly, then we took all of those compounds, the compounds we started with in the original database, the generated biotransformation products and hydrolysis products, and we used a program called CFMID. This is actually a machine learning-based fragmentation model that predicts in silico MSMS spectra for compounds de novo. And so this allowed us to basically generate a computational in silico MSMS library for our entire database that we could then use to screen by high-resolution mass spectrometry. The results of this work, we ended up with about 40,000 different structures, which represent about 17,000 compounds. You can see that most of those actually were biotransformation products, right? And then the compounds that we started with in the EPA database and the AFFF database, and then a number of different overlaps along this database. So this database is actually freely available. We published this here in Analytical Chemistry, and any of you who actually use Thermo Fisher Scientific Instruments, this will be present in the next version of Compound Discover software. So what do we get from this? So this is an example of the molecular network that we can generate from these databases. So this one is an example built around PFOA, which is this sort of central node. So the green nodes here represent compounds that occur in the original databases. All of the arrows represent transformations, either biotransformations or hydrolysis. So, you know, you can see a number of different hydrolyses here, for example, an aldehyde going to hydrolyze and biotransform to PFOA. The purple nodes are transformation products, predicted transformation products, and then compounds that have that are both present in the original database as well as predicted in silico transformations are present in orange. So this is just an example of one of many of the different molecular networks that are actually encoded in this database. And so we can use this for a number of things. But the first thing, of course, that we have to do is use it to serve as a database for us and a library for us in our analytical chemistry work. So we've built this this library, we've built this database that we can use to annotate structures for molecules. But to do that, we have to actually generate the high-resolution MS data. So we're using a Orbitrap-based technology for this. The really important thing here is ultra-high mass accuracy. Generally less than a ppm, usually about half a ppm, and high resolution, so we can get fast and very sort of discrete and high resolution and high accuracy analysis. It's also really fast. We can do 20 hertz MSMS. And so we put this together into a novel workflow that includes online solid phase extraction. So the idea here is to be able to take a sample from the field, water sample, and do essentially no sample prep to it. So all we have to do here is either centrifuge, ideally, or filter to get rid of particulates. And so what we've built is a system where we can inject up to 10 milliliters of sample onto a loading cartridge. This is all automated. We're using a anion exchange, weak anion exchange column here as our loading cartridge. So we load 10 mils. Then we do a transfer. And what's unique here is we're using a three-pump system. So we're back eluting our compounds off our wax cartridge here with a methanolic ammonium hydroxide at a low flow rate, only about 25 microliters per minute. And then this actually gets mixed with a dilution flow, with a makeup flow of an aqueous ammonium acetate, acetic acid buffer to neutralize the ammonium hydroxide and dilute the methanol strong solvent, load and transfer onto our analytical column. And then we do our traditional separation, just using a standard HPLC separation, while we regenerate our cartridge. So all of this is done in less than 30 minutes. The actual separation only takes about 20 minutes. It takes about 10 minutes to actually do the sample preparation in an automated way. This again is published in ESNT Water. This, of course, is work by my former colleague, Gordon Getzinger. Really, really sensitive. So one of the great things about this method is it allows us to do both quantitative as well as non-targeted analysis. This is just an example of, 5 ppt, 5 nanogram per liter standards using this approach. And you can see even at 5 nanograms per liter, we have very, very high sensitivity, lots of signal. And also, importantly, we have really good peak shape, even for the really hydrophilic compounds like PFBA here or PFMOAA over here for the alpha ether acids. Typically, our sensitivity is around 0.1 or less nanograms per liter. So we can be quite sensitive with this method, and it's quite fast. Just to show that we get pretty good recoveries across the entropic efficiencies using that wax cartridge, and good accuracy with NIST SRMs. I guess the one, these sulfonamides actually are difficult to trap and elute, but we can use OASIS HLB to actually improve that. So put all this together, our cheminformatic approach, as well as our online SPE, and we can actually combine this to make to look at a test case. This is an example where there was a gasoline tanker accident near Charlotte, North Carolina. So this is Charlotte right here. This is kind of northwest of Charlotte in Denver, North Carolina. Tanker had an accident, caught on fire, and then the firefighting the firefighters came and sprayed AFFF all over it, as you can see here, to put out the fire. And that, unfortunately, there's a creek. It's right below the picture here that feeds into the Catawba River upstream of the Belmont, North Carolina drinking water treatment plant. So we sent a team out to collect samples upstream and downstream of this spill and analyze for PFAS using our approach. So what we found is that of the about 1,400 different compounds we detected in our non-targeted analysis, 92 of those were tentatively annotated as PFAS from our databases. We can use some visualization techniques like Van Creveland diagrams over here, as well as Kendrick mass defects over here to reveal transformations. And so what's interesting, if you look, this is molecular weight versus retention time. And what you can see is that some of these annotations, you can see compounds that have putative annotations that have arrows that point to compounds that are earlier in retention time, but similar in molecular weight. This is consistent with perhaps transformations, biotransformations happening in the environment after the spill that are making these compounds more hydrophilic. That is, they elute a little earlier. And that's actually further support for that. If you look at the Van Creveland diagram, especially the oxygen to carbon ratio here, you can see a lot of arrows pointing to the right. And so if you're having oxidation, oxidative transformation, those biotransformations often introduce oxygen. And so you'd start to see your Van Creveland diagram plot shift to the right. And then we can also use, we can look at fragment trees. So here's all our fragment trees for our annotated PFAS, and can actually see in some cases these arrows are shared fragments among different analytes from the different MSMS trees. And this allows us to pick out molecular families that share different fragmentation. So when we annotate these, remember, we're using an in silico MSMS library. And so what you can actually see here is the performance of that in silico MSMS library. Purple or blue or green fragments here, lines in these spectra, indicate matches to annotated peaks. These are experimental peaks matched to annotations from our in silico predicted MSMS fragments using a variety of different in silico fragmenters. CFMID and Sirius and CFMID, these are formula-based versus structure-based fragmenters. And what we can see is that compounds that have PFAS that have relatively large non-perfluorinated structures, like this one up here, this FT-SAS compound, All of the peaks are well annotated by the predicted fragments, whereas compounds that have very short and very small side chains that are not perfluorinated give relatively poor matches to the predicted fragments. And that's not surprising, since the perfluorinated part of the molecules tend to be the ones that fragment the most poorly. So we were able to generate actually a molecular network here. This is an example of a 6,2 fluorotelomer species. The numbers next to these nodes represent the rank order of intensity in the analysis. So for example, here's the third ranked most intense peak in the sample set. This is actually 6,2 FT-SAS is the known component of the fluorotelomer-based AFFF that was used in this case. And you can actually see some predicted transformations and from this molecule to a variety of different possible transformation products, some of them already known, like 6,2 fluorotelomer sulfonate. And then some of them are fully novel. So these purple stars here represent compounds that have not been reported previously in the literature as detections, but are predicted transformation products based on our in silico library. So this really shows the power of using cheminformatics in combination with high-resolution mass spectrometry to discover new compounds and new annotations. Okay. Also, you can basically maintain links in this fragmentation tree to the biotransformation networks that were used to generate these molecules. So we put all of this together. So we use online solid phase extraction, high resolution MS non-targeted suspect screening. We then combine this with our traditional triple quad MS-MS target quantitation for about 50 target PFAS. And then in collaboration with Mason and Delef Kanape, my colleagues in the North Carolina PFAS testing network, we include adsorbable organic fluorine analysis, really to give us as comprehensive as possible a picture of PFAS measurement in water. So how do we then apply this to broad scope screening and analysis of sources of PFAS in water and where they pose a risk to human and environmental health? So let's go through a case study in North Carolina waters. And this really starts with our analysis over time here of PFAS in North Carolina drinking water sources. This was done through the PFAS testing network. This is about 375 different sites, all the drinking water intakes for public water supplies in North Carolina, analyzed for a variety of different PFAS in 2019, both target and non-target, quite a rich data set. And what we find is that central North Carolina here tends to have the higher concentrations, relatively high concentrations of PFAS in water supplies. And these are mostly actually perfluorocarboxylic acids. You do see a corridor here of red and orange all the way down to the coast, and that's the Cape Fear River from mostly ether acid compounds from the Chemours plant in Fayetteville, as you saw in the last presentation. If we zoom in a little bit, one of those watersheds in central North Carolina, here's the Cape Fear River. The Haw River is one of the tributaries to the Cape Fear. And so this is sort of the epicenter of those high concentration dots that I showed you in the previous map for PFAS. And if we look in detail at the PFAS complement in the river, both upstream and then downstream of the Fayetteville Works Chemours plant here all the way to Wilmington, what you actually see is that if you look all the way down at King's Bluff, this kind of red and orange, these are the novel Chemours-based PFAS, right? This was sampled, you know, back in 2020, I believe. But then if you actually look up higher, you can see that there are concentrations of PFAS that are quite a bit higher, but they're concentrated in the PFCA, perfluorocarboxylic acid complement. And specifically, you see a big jump in concentration upstream and downstream of Burlington, North Carolina. So we really were interested to find out what's going on there. If we look at in more detail at the Haw River downstream of Burlington, here's Burlington up here, and these communities, these drinking water samples, you can see relatively high concentrations, especially at Pittsboro and then in the Jordan Lake and Haw River down below. But all of these are dominated by perfluorocarboxylic acid. And then if we look more in more detail at what's going on in Burlington, Burlington, North Carolina is historically a textile producing town. And there's a number of textile plants and textile chemical suppliers. So we started working with the Burlington Wastewater Treatment Plant and some community advocates and water keepers to look at what's happening at the Burlington plant. And what's interesting, if you look at the effluent and the influent and effluent at the East Burlington Wastewater Treatment Plant, you can see some strikingly high concentrations of PFAS, subtotal PFAS, in the effluent of the plant, much higher than what's in the influent plant prior to about May 2020. So what's going on here? I mean, obviously the plant isn't manufacturing PFAS, right? So why would you have higher concentrations in the effluent than the influent? Well, so what happened is that in about May 2020, they stopped using a Zimpro wet air sludge oxidation method, which was previously being used to treat some of their sludge and basically feed that back into their influent after thermal oxidation. And so our theory here was that there's some kind of precursor of PFAS that was in the influent but was not analytically visible that then was transformed during this reaction into analytically measurable PFAS in the effluent. So we started looking in detail at what's happening at these various chemical suppliers and textile plants. We partnered with Burlington again to actually sample at the manholes of some of these sewer sheds around Burlington near these textile plants for PFAS. And what we found was actually kind of puzzling. So, you know, remember that we're seeing tens of thousands of parts per trillion of PFAS at the effluent, but here we're seeing relatively low concentrations of measured PFAS in the individual sewer shed samples. These are all the sewer shed samples. So we see one, it's kind of high right here, but still we're only a few hundred nanograms per liter. We then moved over to use the top assay because we thought, okay, we need to probably see if we've got some precursor transformations. The top assay, and I don't want to spend much time on this because we're running out of time, is used to oxidize precursors to measurable PFCAs. You can, for example, transform this fluorotelomer sulfonate to PFCAs using wet oxidation. When we use this approach on those same sewer shed samples, you can see suddenly we're seeing almost 1.4 million parts per trillion. That's 1.4 parts per million of PFAS in that one sewer shed sample, which, if you remember, was only given a couple hundred parts per trillion of target PFAS when we measured it there. So, and then at the effluent of the plant, we're still got 32,000 parts per trillion of PFAS precursor revealed from our top assay. So the loaded, this is basically, we went back and did this at a number of different time points in the effluent and the influent. These textile derived precursors are most of the PFAS loadings going to and from the plant. Over 90% of these textile derived PFAS were removed to sludge during the treatment, right? So you can see this huge difference in the concentrations in the influent and effluent, but still high concentrations of these compounds coming out of the effluent. We got some samples of the actual textile wastewater from the plant that was associated with this particular sewer shed six that gave us the really high concentrations. Sure enough, when we measure the total target PFAS in those samples, only less than 400 nanograms per liter. When we hit it with oxidant and then generate the PFAS profile from the top assay, 10.9 million parts per trillion. So that's 10.9 ppm of PFAS, so quite high. Interestingly, we threw the kitchen sink analytically at this sample with Orbitrap mass spec. We tried GC Orbitrap mass spec. We tried every approach that we could try. We even collaborated with Diana Aga to do some NMR on these samples, and we could not figure out exactly what these compounds were. They gave no signal in our Orbitrap mass spec. A breakthrough came when we realized that we could actually retain all of these precursors on a 30 kilodalton molecular weight ultrafiltration membrane, which told us that what we probably had here is particulate matter, particulate materials that were PFAS precursors. So we then, I actually dusted off a instrument that I used to use in my lab for nanoparticle analysis. This is asymmetric flow, field flow fractionation, or AF4. This is a colloid separation method. And what happens is you inject your colloidal suspension here, and you have a flow that's imposed against an ultrafiltration membrane. Large particles are pushed down against that membrane. Small molecules and smaller particles freely diffuse up into the higher flow of this laminar flow channel. and are separated. So this is essentially like doing chromatography for particles with no stationary phase. So it's excellent for separating particles. And this actually allowed us to confirm, here's a fractogram showing injection of this textile wastewater on our PFAS, AF4, showing the trace of the UV detector here. And then this is fractions collected with our basically reveals after top assay the generation of our PFAS. So you can see this peak of PFAS containing colloids that separates out towards the end of the chromatogram. And then if we overlay that actually with some psi standards, these are polystyrene psi standards, we can see that our side chain fluorinated polymers, which I think is what these are actually about 100 nanometers. So we have colloidal PFAS precursors. So we sort of discovered this new class of PFAS contaminants in textile wastewater. These are PFAS colloids, so PFAS nanoparticles. So we're doing some work to try to track down exactly what the structures are and some additional experiments. But we think what these are is basically fluorotelomer acrylate or fluorotelomer urethane polymers that are actually in colloidal form either during or after the treatment of the textiles at these plants. Okay, so I'm going to wrap up here and just leave you with some conclusions here. I think I've shown you that if you combine analytical cheminformatics with high-resolution mass spectrometry and some online sample preparation, we can do fast, comprehensive PFAS analysis, both qualitative and quantitative. And then high concentrations of PFAS that we're observing in central North Carolina, these are coming from textile manufacturing plants. And so a big takeaway I'd like to drive home is that mass spectrometry and liquid-based mass spectrometry measurements are not going to necessarily catch all of the potential PFAS contaminants that are in these complex samples. Some of these fluorotelomer-based precursors were colloids. And so you need particle separation methods together with oxidative and chemical generation methods like the top assay to reveal the concentrations and the type of PFAS in these samples. One epilogue, what about that sludge that was actually the source of all this PFAS in the Zimpro process in the wastewater? Well, it turns out they actually spread some of the sludge on agricultural fields that are actually unfortunately near the Cane Creek Reservoir, which is the drinking water supply for Chapel Hill, North Carolina. And sure enough, we see high concentrations of PFAS. This is actually work from Andy Lindstrom and Mark Striner back almost 10 years ago. And so now we can actually solve that riddle of where that's coming from. So with that, I'll thank you for your attention. I'll take any questions if there's time.
Thank you very much, Dr. Ferguson, for that really informative presentation. All right, we'll move on to our questions here. Which platform / software or tools did you use to generate your molecular networks?
Right. So the images, the network images, that was that's done in R. And actually, I can't remember exactly what the packages were that my colleague Gordon Getzinger generated those with, but it's a visualization tool within the software package R.
Great. Okay, next question is, ultimately, what can be done to eliminate PFAS from our consumer products? Maybe a broad question for you.
Yeah, what can be done to eliminate PFAS from consumer products? Well, I mean, I think smart green chemistry is the answer there. I think there's unfortunately been a reluctance to move away from PFAS as textile coatings, for example, and paper coatings, because they're so effective. It's very hard to find chemistries that both repel water as well as oils. This is a chemical challenge, a chemist's challenge. It's also hard to find substitutes for some of the firefighting foam applications, but there are efforts to do both of those things right now. And so I think that some green chemistry and hopefully some regulations will help that.
Great. Okay, the next question is, would the textile industry benefit from having their own PFAS analyzer, and would it result in economic benefits to them?
Yeah, actually, I think that that's something that was discussed quite a bit during this project. In particular, for textile industries and also really any other industries that are using PFAS in coatings where they have liquid waste streams, they're going to have to comply with industrial pretreatment programs when they are discharging into municipal wastewater. And so in this case, the only way they could actually detect these compounds were to work with us or work with others that have these sophisticated analytical approaches. There needs to be more routine methods and more routine approaches that can address that for industries that need those approaches. And I think it's sorely needed.
Right, great. Okay, the next, it's more of a a question about if you can provide links to the free softwares from EPA. And so maybe you could go into the chat and do that.
Sure, I'll do that. Yep.
Yeah, great.
I certainly can. And that's, I think, the Compox dashboard and maybe the chemical transformation simulator.
Perfect. The next question is, what's the best way to educate the general public on an emerging contaminant?
Yeah, this has been something that we've really struggled with within the PFAS testing network, because that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to make sure that the public understands what emerging pollutants are, where they're coming from, and what the implications are for exposure. Those are all really, really difficult challenges to grapple with. I think the first step is really actually getting yourself out there as a scientist and making sure that you are talking to community groups. One of the great things about the SRP program is that there's community engagement cores. And so I engage with our communities through our community engagement core, as well as other CEC efforts.
Right, great. The next question is, can you recommend some papers on sludge and PFAS for researchers who are working, or I think they're looking for information on researchers who are conducting work on biosolids and sludge relating to PFAS?
Sure, for sure. Well, one of them was speaking just a little while ago. So Dana Aga has been working on that, I think. But also, I know that Detlef Knape, who is a SRP grantee at NC State, does quite a bit of work on biosolids. And then the US EPA, Mark Striner and Andy Lindstrom's group at here also in North Carolina. So there's there's an awful lot of PFAS research going on in North Carolina, as you've probably seen today. But there's a lot of researchers here active in that.
Okay, great. Next question. Let's see. I might have missed the time frame for the textile facility samples. Does it mean the side chain PFAS are still used in U.S. textiles industries?
They absolutely are. We have, I think it's unfortunate, but these samples were analyzed this year. So those concentrations of PFAS, you know, tens of millions of parts per trillion, 10 ppm PFAS in the wastewater, that's a 2022 and 2023 result. They are absolutely still using side-chain fluorinated polymers in textiles.
Okay, one last question I think we have time for. Do you think our analytical methods are underestimating PFAS concentrations, considering the example you provided with textile sewer inputs and needing the top assay to find the analytical PFAS compounds?
That's an easy one to answer. The answer is yes. So top assay is one tool, but it's not the be-all and end-all. What we really need is better total organic chlorine methods. Dana Aga showed the NMR method. That's great, but we need better sensitivity. And so we're working on that in our lab.
Perfect. Thank you. All right. We will move on to our concluding slides here. Thank you again to Dr. Ferguson and to the other two speakers, Dr. Aga and Dr. Baker, for three really excellent and informative presentations. So before we conclude here, let's take a look back at the seminar homepage. This website will be active from today on and contains important resources such as links to download our presentation materials, contact information for speakers, and more information about the Superfund research program and a link to our feedback form. We do ask that you consider filling out the online feedback form, and we look at your comments as we continue to try and improve the content and delivery mechanisms. You can also request a confirmation email from the feedback page as a record of your participation in today's event. here are a variety of links, if we can move forward one page, to learn more about the Superfund research program. I encourage you to check out the various components of their website to learn more about the program and initiatives. And next slide. I would also like to remind participants of the various ways to stay connected to ensure you don't miss any webinars. So for more information on EPA's CLUIN webinars, please refer to the CLUIN.org website. You can also subscribe to the monthly newsletter, Tech Direct. We encourage you to visit the SRP Risk e-Learning webpage, check out our monthly research brief, and subscribe to the Risk e-Learning listserv for information about upcoming sessions. And you can also follow SRP on X, formerly known as Twitter. All right, I would like to encourage everyone to join us for the next two sessions on this webinar series on October 20th and November 8th. And if you are unable to attend live, an archive will also be available shortly after the event. With that, it is time to conclude today's session. Thank you very much for your participation, and thank you again to our presenters for their time spent preparing and sharing their presentations with us today.